My name's Ben Whitehouse. I am Literature Coordinator for Green Belt Festival 2009. Thank you very much for choosing to come to this talk. You're about to hear the social media guru, genius, radio presenter, and marketeer to Birmingham, John Bounds. And his topic is 11/11/11. And I'll let him explain why. Please make him feel welcome with the usual Green Belt welcome.
Hi, thanks for coming. My name is John Bounds, as Ben kindly said, and I'm going to introduce two quite strange and disparate concepts to you. One is psychogeography, the study of emotion and place, which has really been going on since sort of late 50s. The other is the 11 bus, the outer circle from Birmingham. Now, the 11 bus has a long, incredible history. Once there were two buses, the 12 and the 14. And then, in round about 1923, they were linked to form a complete circle, circumnavigating Birmingham. So for just one simple bus ticket, you could go all the way around Birmingham without getting off. And that's very important. I'll give you some facts. The Birmingham Outer Circle, which is what you can see here, is 27 miles long. A little bit of it isn't in Birmingham, which we're kind of upset about. A little bit of it is in Samwell. It follows what some would term to be the city's ring road, the A4040, roughly. There are 272 bus stops. The route takes in 233 schools and colleges, 69 leisure facilities, 40 pubs, although pubs are closing all the time, 19 retail centres, 6 hospitals, and links some 15 sort of commercial centres or small sort of in Birmingham suburbs. There are 40 11s on the road at any one time. They don't stop. I spoke to the service manager at Acocks Green Bus Depot, where they live, and he said they can keep going for about 2 days without needing any diesel. But the service doesn't run at night, so that never arises. But it's interesting to know that in the event of an emergency, they could keep going. When it was first released in the 20s, it was a prized thing. The local corporation released this book, exhorting bummies to see the suburbs of Birmingham going round on the 11 bus. A lovely picturesque thing. And this is what people tended to do. I mean, I'm not one that says Birmingham hasn't got a lot of entertainment to offer, but historically, people have spent a lot of time going round and round the 11 bus. In the 70s, I can remember lots of kids were just packed onto the top deck of a number 11 by their mum with a bottle of Blue Pop and a 10-penny mix-up, and told not to get off till they come round again. So the mum and dad got some quiet time on a Sunday afternoon. And if their mum and dad really liked each other, they had to go around twice. But Birmingham, it's got a huge place in Birmingham's cultural history. Simon Le Bon of Duran Duran wrote Hungry Like the Wolf on a number 11 bus. That's what he says. Frank Skinner wanted to put it into room 101, but then he's not a real Brummie, so what can you tell? One of the blokes out of Jethro Tull, they're still going by the way, flute and everything, wrote a song about it called The Outer Circle, and there's at least 4 or 5 songs called The Outer Circle. It was voted number 70 in the 101 best things to do in Birmingham in a recent poll. In the last series of the reality TV show Big Brother, because two of the contestants from Birmingham, they put a number 11A bus stop out there to smoke for people. I think the concept being that you can wait a long time and it doesn't turn up. But I've been obsessed, long obsessed with the 11 bus. It holds a special place in Birmingham's memory. The whole act of going round, there's a kind of wonderful metaphor. If you want to really understand the city, to go round it and round it without kind of having any choice in the matter. I think it's really important that everybody does this. And if you do come to Birmingham, and I advise a lot of tourists, this is a trip that you really should make. So we can make it a little bit more quickly than the 2.5 to 3 hours it takes to go around, more in a rush hour. I've filmed the complete loop and sped it up. We're going to have a quick look at that now. The film is called King's Heath to King's Heath in 5 minutes because I live in King's Heath, that's where I got on. Of course, being a circular route, you can choose to go clockwise or anti-clockwise. For this particular instance, I chose anti-clockwise. And here's a little bit of an experience of what it's like to wait for a bus in King's Heath. Look there, it's coming. It's a beautiful bus. So because there's 40 of them, it's very difficult to keep to a timetable. They do try, but the inevitable 4, 3, 5, at one point in my knowledge, 6, come along at once. But it's very important to do that once, and I think we need to do that. I won't make you watch all of it, even though sped up to 5 minutes is important, but I won't make you watch all of it. So this is what it's like to get on a bus in Birmingham. An experience you should all experience. And I wasn't paying another £1.70 to go around again. And they also focus on the camera, because I also wasn't looking through the camera for the entire room. Focused on the raindrops. It's a historical document you're watching. So now you've kind of got the experience. But once round isn't enough, or it wasn't enough for me anyway. So when the numbers aligned, I thought, November's the 11th month, the 11th day of November, 11 bus, why don't we spend 11 hours on 11 bus going round and round? And this has come as my interest as a soccer job. I thought that you could go round and round and round and round and kind of lose that sense of space, lose that concept of where you were, and just kind of take the city for what it was and get a little bit dizzy as well. I thought I could just me myself wasn't enough, so I had to try and encourage as many people to do it. I've got this concept of I'll explain psychogeography. Psychogeography kind of started in the 50s in Paris. A group of artists called the Lettrists were the first to attempt it. Basically, it's an attempt to understand the urban landscape. They use different techniques, the emotions in the urban landscape. They use different techniques to kind of trick themselves out of their normal everyday emotions. One of them is to act as a flaneur, a wanderer, where you walk as the spirit takes you, letting your emotions be your guide and kind of walk aimlessly. And this is one of the first things they tried to do in the sort of ninth arrondissement in Paris. They tried this, but ultimately it's kind of it's unsuccessful because it's very difficult to divorce your emotions from your everyday feelings, so you have a new experience of a place. One of the other things they tried was a technique they called the derive, and the idea of the derive is they impose some order on the walk or on the sort of the exploration, but it's not the correct order. One of the main tricks was to navigate a city with a map for the wrong city. Very famously, they used to navigate Paris using a map of London. I mean, listen, navigating Paris is difficult enough anyway, but a map of London. So this was the technique they used. But again, for me, kind of ultimately unsuccessful, because despite you've made a conscious decision to do that, you can never experience the places as pure emotions, because you know this. And also, if you're recording something, you're deliberately trying to make an artistic statement, then your experience of it is slightly different to the experience of someone who just chances upon it for the first time. and also the Letterists and the Situationists, which followed them into the psychogeographic realm, were a bit up themselves, to be honest. This is how they define psychogeography. Study of the precise law and specific effects of the... Yeah, look, it's basically how you feel when you're in a place, that's it. But they wanted to cover it and couch it in very, very sort of arty and very deep terms. I kind of think it's possible to kind of break that down now, because I think everybody, with blogging and with people recording their lives a lot more on the internet with more digital cameras, whatever, it's a lot more possible to kind of do psychogeography and do psychogeographic things without knowing that you're doing it. So the 11-11-11 thing was kind of part of that. If I could encourage people to just spend 11 hours on the 11 bus with me because they thought it was a good idea and record their experiences, then we'd get some really interesting psychogeographic results without them knowing that they were taking part in my psychogeographic explanations. So I just told them, can you blog it, please? As far as I'm concerned, is blogging is putting stuff on the internet. That's it. That's how I define it. People will define it in all sorts of ways, but putting your thoughts, your emotions on the internet is about as far as I go. So this was the concept for 11-11-11. But there were rules. Everything has to have rules. The rules were, get on the 11C, so we're going clockwise, at 11 a.m, or as near as damn it, on the 11th of the 11th. Get off the 11C at 10 p.m, 11 hours later, or as near as you can. You can get on and off the bus as many times as you want, as long as you put a day saver, otherwise it just costs you a fortune. Document your journey. Film, writing, photography, cross-stitch, knitting. Amigurumi, which is apparently making felt models of food, is what someone wanted to do. Poetry, blog, whatever you like. And meet up if you want to, or if it happened naturally. I didn't say, everybody get on with me. We just started it. So in the end, what I did, of course, it's the internet age. First thing you do if you're going to do anything is set up a Facebook group. 74 people joined the Facebook group. 34 said they would do it. Now, it's very easy to click yes on a Facebook group. I didn't really think 34 people would do it. The second thing you do on the internet is open a t-shirt shop to try and get the money back. So these are still available. Where does the 11 go there? This comes from a phrase that my friend Gary used to say. He was sort of not very committed to keeping a job. He used to do a lot of agency work, and when he was living in a house, and whenever the agency phoned him up about a job, he asked two questions. One, what's the money? Two, does the 11 go there? Because it was as long as he could stay on the 11, it only cost him one bus fare to get to work, and that was his thing. So we did that. So what we did then, we ended up with, I reckon, about 30 people in the end doing it. Not everybody stopped on for 11 hours. In fact, I estimate 4 or 5, myself included, stopped on and did 11 hours. But a lot of people did it, a lot of people recorded their experiences, and it was really interesting. One of the ones, this is some of the photographs taken by an artist called Alicia, who borrowed a fisheye lens camera, and she was documenting. She's an interesting artist. She specifically does art about public transport, which is kind of nicely connected, but she wasn't really interested in the kind of psychogeographical aspects of it in the same way I was. I'm interested in kind of the triggered emotions, the odd memories, the odd facts that you find out. For example, through someone doing it, we found out the first pub in Birmingham to have splash pans in the gents' urinals was the Old House at Home. We don't know what splash pans are. I'm thinking they've long since fallen out of use, but we found that out. And for another guy who was live blogging the event, this was kind of a big treat for him. Well, a big treat for me for watching him to do it. He's going past it and he's going, 12:24. Did I just go through Perry Bar without noticing? 12:28, school kids on the bus. Must be lunchtime. 12:33. Bus seems to be emptying. I'm not sure why. Maybe there are shops nearby. Oh, shops. Lots of them. It helps to look out of the window. Buffet Island. What a great name. Strange stranded Chinese restaurant with mock Tudor stylings. And it is there. It used to be a pub. Almost about to go under the M6. Now, the 11 bus passes through and underneath the M6. three or four times, which is kind of interesting, because you think the motorway went straight through, but the bus manages to come through a lot of times, and that's kind of maybe where some of the reputation Birmingham gets for being a sort of concrete nightmare. Come see you forever going through and underneath motorway junctions. Most of the cities tend to have motorways going around them. We've just got two great big ones going straight through. Over a railway, towards the airport. I got off the bus in South Yardley. We're allowed to get off for an hour at a time. And some people concentrate their thoughts on what they were doing. There's Michael actually live blogging it on his phone. You can see he was more intently live blogging than he was looking out the window. So his experiences were very much kind of in his head with a little bit of the outside stuff. But some people thought if they take it and they take people watching as their insert. It's about 1:50. Claire and I are still in Harborne. We're waiting on the front seat at the top of the deck of the Birmingham's Leisure number 11 bus. We're sitting on the right side of the bus, and on Lordswood Road, a girl sitting to our left gets up and click-clacks her way down the stairs in a pair of presumably fashionable high-heel plimsolls. This may be fairly inconsequential to you, but to me it was a catalyst for a minor elevation. Sitting on the front seat of the top deck might give you a great view of the road ahead. When it comes to inter-bus people watching, it's far from ideal. Visibility is seriously impaired due to the fact that everybody else is behind you. But there's one person who is very good to watch from the front seat at the top deck. That's the driver. Although, Birmingham's just recently had a new load of buses. On the old buses, there was a complicated periscope system of mirrors leading up from the driver that you could look down and see the top of his head. But if he ever looks up at you, you'll get thrown off. That's what happens, apparently. So this guy moves down from the lower deck. There was 12 adult females, 2 with infants, 9 adult males and 8 juveniles, 5 female and 3 male, of varying ages, races and creeds. 5 adults, 3 female and 2 male, were reading or appearing to read daily newspapers, magazines, or this week's Take a Break. 2 of the adults and 1 juvenile were listening to music or appearing to listen to music on portable MP3 players. 1 adult male and 1 juvenile female were conducting or appearing to conduct, it seems very scientific things methods, mobile telephone conversations with unidentified parties on matters pertaining to, in the first instance, somewhat contentious business transaction involving an otter. And in the second, a highly detailed account of a series of regrettable and somewhat lurid romantic entanglements involving a third party known only as Sonia. And this is quite interesting, how people will take their personal lives and they're onto the bus. Some people will be completely open, some people want to be cut off completely and not see anything. Stare out the window with their MP3 players on. There's a music, someone did a music survey. After crossing the Hagley Road, home to my old sixth form college, the number 11 saunters briefly on Bearwood High Street as another song comes to mind. This time it's This Is What She's Like by Dex's Midnight Runners. Willfully uncommercial and critically underrated from their 1985 album Don't Stand Me Down. On the album version of the song, the little nibble cafe on Bearwood High Street is mentioned. And this is all going on in Tom's head. The little nibble closed last January, or the January previous to us doing this. And that's kind of an interesting sort of, I do some work with the Birmingham Music Archive, and they're attempting to document all the places, the hangouts, not just the venues, but the people, the things that made the music in Birmingham go forward, and places like cafes where people just hang out, places where pubs that were kind of lax in their rules and their morphologies, and musicians felt comfortable hanging out in there, they're all sort of closing, and that's going to be a real problem. And there are people that react strongly to the place names, just from another guy who's right. We're driving through Winston Green, and Winston Green, of course, is best known for the prison. In fact, to most Brummies, Winston Green means prison. In this respect, it joins a long list of notorious locations that seem forever lumbered with deep-seated incarceration. Notorious places like Strange Ways, Alcatraz, and Port Merion. Which is a bit of a shame, really, because if you manage to separate the word from its links in the local prison, then Winston Green itself is quite a pretty name for a place. It wouldn't seem out of place on Trumpton, alongside Campbellwick Green in Chickling. Of course, that's easier said than done. The place and the prison seem to be neuro-linguistically fused in the popular imagination. And this is true. So the first things you do when you think about a place are intrinsically linked. To me, Acox Green means not the green, it means the post office, because my mum went to work at Acox Green Post Office, and the only reason I ever had any reason to go to Acox Green was to see my mum at work. So Acox Green for me means post office. I don't think of anything else being there but the post office. And while we're still on the 11 bus, we're coming through Perry Bar, and we're now passing the Crown and Cushing pub. There's been a Crown and Cushing standing at the corner of Wellington Road and Birchfield Road as long as I remember. Although it hasn't always been this Crown and Cushing. The current incumbent is a fairly modern-looking, functional affair that, by my somewhat unreliable estimation, was constructed in the late 80s or possibly the early 90s. I wasn't on the number 11 at the time, so I didn't take any notice. It was built on the site of a more traditional-looking red brick boozer called, unsurprisingly, the Crown and Cushing. And as I recalled, across the road, there used to be, and what used to be the old Crown and Cushing, was a smaller pub squeezed between a row of shops that was called the New Crown and Cushing. Now, I'm no expert on pub name entomology, but I think it's safe to assume that the New Crown and Cushing was a late arrival on the scene, being a younger pub. I imagine it was a bit of an upstart fueled by youthful exuberance and swaggering cockiness, although it probably skipped on the piss and vinegar for health and safety reasons. I must have felt a bit annoyed when the old Crown and Cushing was bulldozed and replaced with the Crown and Cushing that was newer than the New Crown and Cushing. For one thing, it had to change its name. And these buildings change, and these buildings evolve, and people's impressions of the buildings evolve. And this is kind of some of the great bits that I was getting from people not knowing that what they were doing was investigating the emotions of the place for me, coercing them. It's surprising how much wasteland there is around the area and how many of the smaller shops have been closed down. Coming to Yardley, I think it was, there's a whole shopping centre that's been closed. One of the advantages of seeing the world from the front end of the top deck of a number 11 bus is that you get to witness all the juicy street level stuff you'd normally miss while driving through underpasses and over flyovers. That's why I'm surprised to see the library that used to sit on the corner of Birchford Road and Aston Lane has now been demolished. And that's why I say out loud, and a bit too loudly, where did that go? And Birmingham is kind of a changing place as you go through it. Suburbs are linked by place, but they're really not very linked at all. Personally, for me, the first sort of next suburb we came to from where I got on was a place called Bourneville, famous for its Cadbury's chocolate. A place built for the Cadbury's factory by the Cadbury family, a Quaker family who built an absolutely beautiful place full of village greens, cricket pitches, recreation halls, shops, churches. It's a very, very beautiful place, but it doesn't seem anything like Birmingham. It doesn't seem attached to the next bit of Birmingham at all. Bourneville seems the most suburban suburb of them all, which really in a state. Suburbs need more than the endless, not straight, for some reason, roads with heavy foliage and cars. They need focal points. Bourneville's focal point for me is leaving it. I've never been to Bourneville in the same way as I've never really been to the past. It wouldn't be right. It looks focused in on itself, and it's not really part of Birmingham for me. It has an insular sort of industriousness, an order, a factory, play, a road, out. And if Bourneville is connected, but it's disconnected from its surroundings, the next bit of Birmingham comes with Selly Oak. Selly Oak kind of is dominated by two hospitals, Selly Oak Hospital, unsurprisingly, and the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, where I was born many years ago. But that Queen Elizabeth Hospital has been knocked down at the moment, and a huge new super hospital, the Queen Elizabeth Hospital 2, the sequel, is being built. It's huge and imposing, and it looks for all the world as if something is landed. I don't know if you've seen the Selfridges building in the centre of Birmingham. That's intended to look like an alien spaceship just landing and plopped. It doesn't really. It looks like a nothing. But this new hospital is the biggest building I've ever seen outside a science fiction film. It looks for all the world like the aliens from Independence Day are about to come down and explode it spectacularly. And that'd be a pity, because it's all been built with public-private finance money and we still end up paying for it. this is kind of what I'm talking about, the whole idea of disconnecting. But a lot of you probably write things, write a diary or write a blog, or maybe you Twitter. You're creating these kind of mini emotion packets, these mini sort of psychogeographical expressions all the time. Some people will deliberately do things, some people will deliberately map in the area. This is a guy that came on the route, and he decided that he was going to map every time a bus came in the opposite direction past him. I mean, that's kind of interesting time emotion study, but I don't know what his emotions were. Ooh, that's a bus. Maybe he gets really excited, maybe we learned more about him than we have done about the emotions of the place. So this is what I call conversational psychogeography, and this is kind of a new thing that I'm kind of trying to get started. The idea that when you're talking online in blogging or Twitter or whatever, you're having an online conversation. People refer to it as the conversation. So you're not being the psychogeographer, you're contributing to a psychogeographic conversation. Each tweet, if you're Twittering, gets assigned a place. You set up on Twitter your location. And if you just set up on the website, you said it wants to be your hometown. If you're using an iPhone or some other clients, each tweet is automatically tagged by GPS, your exact location. It lets people do things like this. This is Twitter Vision, where people can, you watch this, twittervision.com, they go to the site and it just scrolls around each tweet from a different place in the world. So I've been starting to do this. I've been starting to take a feed of all the tweets that have come from within Birmingham. And what I do, I'm analysing them for emotion. If you see that about three or fourth tweet down there is the word hate. And this is really unscientific, and people can do this much better. Proper psychologists can do this much better. They know much more about this. I'm looking for the words like hate, love, good, bad, win, lose. And I'm assigning them points out of 20, from plus 10 to negative 10. So hate would be a strong negative 10. Love would be a strong 10. So all these tweets get totaled up, allowing me to give Birmingham an emotional score at any one point. It's quite a simple computer program that does this, but it's doing it all the time. And it's allowing me, well, first I tweet out back to the crowd a rating twice a day. But then I create a graph. And this is the graph of the first half of the year for Birmingham's emotional rating. In January, people were really happy. Christmas, presents, some time off work. And then there's a little dip. This was the thing we called apostrophe gate. You may have seen this on the news. A local councillor who was in the transport department decided that apostrophes were just too much work for road signs. It was spending too much time in council meetings arguing about whether a place name had an apostrophe or it didn't. So they made a snap decision, no apostrophes. And people on Twitter, being a quite sort of grown up literary crowd, decided they didn't like that. So you go through, and this is the kind of emotions that people can see. And this is an emotion mapping that I didn't do of the city of New York. The high points are the high levels of emotion. The different colours contain the different types of emotion. This is based on a survey. This is not based on Twitter. This is not a real-time thing. This is someone's actually going around. So the normal way statisticians measure emotional well-being is to go and ask people with a survey, but people lie. If you ask someone, are you feeling okay? They say, yeah, of course I am. They're not going to tell you how depressed they are, how down they are, how bad these huge, tall, claustrophobic buildings make them feel. They're going to say yes. They're going to say they're feeling good. They're going to say they're feeling great. But when you're talking, just everyday talking, you're not thinking about it. You're letting these emotions slip. And people have been doing a lot of work on this. A site called We Feel Fine does very similar to what I do with the Birmingham Emotion Feed, but it looks for all different sorts of emotions. It looks on all different sorts of services. It doesn't, however, allocate them to place. It just gives the whole of the internet scores for different emotion words. And it took a lot more emotion words. And it doesn't, this at least, they don't kind of separate. If you say, I feel good, you might really feel good. You might be saying, I feel good, ironically. You might be quoting James Brown. But they don't separate that. They can't separate that. The sort of neuro natural language processing isn't quite there. It's almost there. But we can really combine that, and they can even drill it down to sort of individual emotions. That's how they go. So what we can do, we're just about to be able to do this. It's three or four sort of sciences coming together. It's the science of cartography. It's the mapping stuff, all these things related to place. It's the science of natural language processing, trying to get these emotions out of these utterances that people are doing. And then it's kind of, it's what, it's the sort of the slightly discredited science of psychogeography coming into play, mapping those places to emotions and getting it real time and getting it live. Now, councils, organisations spend an absolute fortune asking people whether their neighbourhoods are suitable for them. It's been an absolute fortune. There are huge government bodies dedicated to doing this research. You can kind of, very, very roughly, do it automatically on the fly. You can see how people react to the new road system really quickly. Okay, they need your reactions. Great, rubbish. Probably ask more questions than they give direct answers to. But they let us know what the right questions are to ask. They let us know what things to investigate. And this is what town planners and people of that ilk and councils and things will really need to start to be looking at in the future. They'll need to be looking at how your emotions that you're expressing anyway, just because you want to, relate to where you are. And they need to know what effect that the built environment is having on people. And this is a really, really good technique and a simple way of doing it. And I'm kind of hoping in the next few years that the sort of the science is going to catch up, because you might say, oh no, it's a little bit unscientific, but in the same way as when you do a poll for the election, the way you make sure that it kind of evens itself out is that's a huge sample. If you ask 10 people, one person skews it. If you ask 10,000 people, one person's lying or getting it wrong or not quite saying what they mean doesn't matter. So if we ask these millions of people who are sharing their thoughts and emotions on the internet, we can kind of say that that one person saying, I feel good, and not meaning it, meaning ironic, that one person pretending to be James Brown can kind of be discounted. We can get real emotions and real feelings. And I'd love to see a kind of real-time map of the 11 route going round. I'd like to see if that, yay, the bus has arrived. I've been waiting for the bus. It's here. I'm going home. Or I'm getting where I need to be. If we could track those emotions to see if we could actually track where the buses are without actually knowing where the buses are. Because if you think about it, putting little GPS sensors on buildings and temperature sensors on buildings and all different sensors on cars to know what you're doing and to control the environment is really odd, because people are telling you everything you need to know if you just know how to look for it. And I think we're going to see an explosion of kind of geography is going to be cool, and I think that's really odd, but mapping and geography is going to be really cool, and this is why, because suddenly it's about emotion, it's about place. And it's about what everybody thinks rather than only the people who know the science. And I think that's really exciting. And I think it can really help make our cities and, by extension, the rest of the world a better place. Thank you very much.
John, thank you very much for another interesting and inspiring look at Birmingham and everything that's kind of pouring out of it. Are there any comments, questions from the floor? If you just hold on, I'll bring the mic to you.
I was just wondering, are you a blue laser over the van?
I'm blue, one each. Oh no, wasn't it? It was 2-1, something scored in the last minute.
Okay, anyone else?
Yep. How do you think your exploration of the number 11 route would have been different if you'd walked it rather than been on the bus?
I wouldn't have been able to keep it up for 11 hours. The local radio station used to do a thing called the walkathon. And because the 11 route is almost exactly a marathon length. But they used to do it as a sponsored walk on an August bank holiday Monday. And people used to collapse. The St John's Ambulance were on permanent standby. People just didn't tend to make it round. I think it would have been perhaps slightly more detailed, but more patchy. I think I wouldn't have got the broad picture of how suburbs fit together. I thought I've got an emotion about this place, I've got an emotion about that place. And it's very difficult to write or tweet or blog while you're walking, so sitting down on the bus was really useful for that.
You talked a lot about suburbia, but have you considered doing, say, 8 hours on the number 8? Because actually the city centre is a really, really interesting area. And I would argue that there's more diversity on the number 8 route than there is on the 11.
Ooh, it's possible. I actually think the number 8 route is probably more diverse in population, but less diverse in types of area, if you see what I mean. It's a lot of, to be honest, going around that many times would probably really do your head in. The 8 route doesn't have the sort of emotional significance the 11 does for me. So, but had we thought of it in August, the first time, we might well have done that.
Think, what's the scope for consuming the kind of data you're generating actually on the bus?
Ooh, well, it depends who's going to visualise it. As long as you've got your iPhone or your BlackBerry, you can take in a lot of it. There's a lot of augmented reality applications about to be released. They are basically, you point your camera at something and it overlays information on it. There's absolutely nothing to stop this data, if the processing power's there to release it quick enough to be there live.
Sorry, I didn't really phrase it well. I really meant, what impact would you think it'd have on the people who were able to get it on the bus?
That's interesting. I think it's an old kind of scientific truism that if you measure something, you're affecting it. And by being aware of the emotions that of the place that you're in generates, that may either drag you down or lead you to actually act to change that. If you think you're in an area where people are upset, then I think you would be given a kind of motivation to do something about that. I think knowing that there's a problem is the first step to trying to solve a problem. I think I genuinely hope that most humans would react in that way.
Does it matter which way you went round?
A lot of people were upset when I filmed it anti-clockwise. I said anti-clockwise wasn't where it was at. I think if we do it this year, because this was last November, we'll go the other way around to try and get a balance. I think almost some kind of ping-ponging might work. But in 11 hours, we managed to get around 3 times. So maybe we'd have to go around 1.5 times and 1.5 times back. Interesting. I think it might give you a different impression of how the suburbs fit together. If you're moving from affluent to poor rather than poor to affluent, I think that could kind of change your opinions a lot.
Did the bus driver know what you were doing, and did he express any opinion about you?
No, none of the bus drivers know what we're doing. I didn't want to explain it particularly to them. Originally, I didn't want to ask the bus company because I thought they might say no. But I did in the end, and they were quite supportive of it. Not supportive enough to give me a free ticket, but supportive enough not to stop us doing it.
I was just wondering, you talked about asking like 10,000 people as opposed to 10 people and how that skews how the one person in 10 can skew the data, but if you're on, aren't you limiting it by how you're collecting it with using Twitter and stuff? And you talked about an iPhone, how many people have them and the type of people that have them then limit.
Oh, indeed.
You get.
Actually, almost everybody I know has got an iPhone, but then that's because of the people I know. It causes great problems, and a lot of work I do sort of in my professional life is about digital inclusion. And I think for me, one of the drivers how we can talk to councils and organisations and government about digital inclusion is actually that it makes it easier for people to express themselves to them so they can change things and actually get proper data rather than, I think what a lot happens is areas get things imposed on them by central government without proper consultation. And I think a huge driver towards people getting a better deal is actually becoming digitally included so that their emotions can be measured, if you see what I mean.
I'm just wondering what you think the emotional relationship Birmingham's people have with its bus system is, and whether you think that's any different to anywhere else in the country.
I think our love for the 11 is slightly stronger than anybody else's love for any bus anywhere. I think London has a very emotional relationship with its tube system, one it doesn't have with its bus system. I think it's the different emotional resonances from different forms of transport, and I think Birmingham actually has a huge resonance with its roads. At least in the last 30 or 40 years, it's got a huge kind of negative reaction from its roads and the road system and gridlock and the concrete collar and things they call that. And I think I think the buses are very much of that, if you see what I mean. They're kind of in the thick of the people, and I think that's kind of why Birmingham has a kind of a strong relationship with its bus services. Actually, the 11 is huge. The 11 is an oddity. People don't get quite as obsessed about anything else.
I just wanted to ask you, it was significant that you were travelling in a circle. I mean, I came in a bit late, so you might have said this already, but you know, when you travel in a straight line, then you're heading towards a destination. In a circular route, destination becomes less important and you just have the sense of travelling.
Completely, I think that's very important. That's one of the reasons why this was a great experiment for doing this sort of thing. It was to travel without a destination in mind. It's one of the main psychogeographical techniques to kind of divorce your mind from, you know, the workaday commute or the workaday travelling to actually do something. It would be possible to let the route be dictated by something else that kind of dislocated you, but a circle is kind of the easiest one to do. And it meant that I could get off by my house after having got on by my house without having changed the buses.
Do you think if projects like this were replicated in other cities, as far as they could be, lots of cities don't have a circular bus route, but and in connection with sort of the emotional data that you were gathering, that would help sort of alter wider public perceptions of certain cities and certain areas within those cities?
I think that would depend how the data gets analysed. There's always some spin you can put on raw data. I think very few people have got the time to look at the raw data and analyse it for themselves. It would make an incredibly interesting comparison, certainly. I would love to see something similar done on the Circle Line in London. Obviously, people have to get up and off to check where they were every so often. And there's Berlin has got a very sort of similar central tube station. And that was incredibly interesting during the Cold War, as you went through East Berlin. If you got on in the West, but you couldn't get off, and kind of, I'd love to have seen some kind of similar feelings and emotion kind of maps about that. It would be brilliant to see. Yeah, got to find somebody as strange as me from each city though to do it. Are you volunteering?
Well, why not?
Okay. Oh, one last comment.
It's a bit greedy because I have had one. I just wanted to ask the audience, how many people in the room have actually travelled on the number 11 bus in Birmingham?
You're kidding! That's phenomenal.
It's a captive audience.
I'm astonished. Absolutely. Okay, what? Absolutely, final.
Hiya. Given that the number 8 has had a musical written about it, will you be writing the number 11 musical anytime soon?
At 2 hours 45 minutes, it's actually probably about the right length for a big Rodgers and Hammerstein number. I think I might.
And with that startling revelation, ladies and gentlemen, John Bounds. John's going to be with us tomorrow evening for one final hurrah.